Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:36 p.m. on Tuesday, March 12, 2016. Present, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Pruitt, Representative Guerra, myself, Co-Chair Thompson, Representative... He's not here. Co-Chair Newman, Representative Munoz, Representative Edgman, and Representative Guttenberg. Others will be showing up shortly. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones. No electronic devices allowed in committee. On today's schedule, we have Senate Bill 147, Senior Benefits Program Eligibility, SCR 1, Civics Education Task Force, and HB 317, Forfeiture. No civil in rem, only criminal. First, we'll hear Senate Bill 147, Senior Benefits Program Eligibility by Senate Rules by Request of the Governor. Here to present the bill to the committee is Mr. Sean O'Brien, Division Director for the Department of Public Assistance for Health and Social Services. Along with him is Monica Windham, Policy Chief, Division of Public Assistance, available here for questions also. Please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and tell us about your bill.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sean O'Brien. I am the Division Director for the Division of Public Assistance under the State Department of Health and Social Services. And with me?
For the record, my name is Monica Windham. I'm Chief of Policy and Program Development for the Division of Public Assistance.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you again for having an opportunity to hopefully get through another one fairly quickly for you. This is another really straightforward, short, hopefully easy to follow along and make quick order on Senate Bill 147. And just simply, this is a bill that really is resulting from work that wasn't done when the program initially started in 2007, which was simply to make sure that we included for the eligibility guidelines U.S. citizens and the qualified alien status group, which we actually have in every other category within the Division of Public Assistance. So this would make it consistent through all of our programs. It certainly was not intended as an oversight back when the program was created, but we are catching up to it. And what I can tell you is that we have identified approximately 16 individuals who would fall into the category that would be not included further if this bill was passed in terms of not meeting the criteria. And that is how we came up on the fiscal note with an approximate $43,200 annual savings based on average senior benefits that we pay and the numbers that we've identified that don't meet this criteria. I don't have anything else, except I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from committee. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've been administering this program for years, and so where did it come up? I mean, to start, did the request to look for how many weren't eligible? I mean, I'm sorry, they were eligible then. Now they're not going to be eligible if we pass this. And you're going to save $43,000. How hard is it for you to do the search for eligibility now? And what documentation is given when somebody applies for senior benefits that you can do that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I am going to defer to Monica on that level of detail because she's the content expert.
So. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we don't collect citizenship information for senior benefits because it's not required. However, what we did a cross match to identify the 16 that we did identify. We did a cross match with those that are on our other programs where we have verified citizenship, and we found just the 16 that had applied for other programs. They haven't been approved because they didn't meet the citizenship requirement, but we could tell what their citizenship was.
Representative Guttenberg.
Sorry, Mr. You know, this is an interesting concept. I'm just not sure why. I mean, it seemed like it could have gone into something else for all the work. You know, I think the cost of a single bill going through this is more than your savings, but I'll save it for now, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here again, once again today. I think you said it, that the $43,200 savings represents the 16 people who were normally or who had received the benefit. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that is true.
Okay. Follow-up? Because the way the way you read this, it just says that the change would make senior benefits easier to administer. It doesn't really say what you said, but that's why I had a question about that. And then, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kawasaki,
thank you. Actually, I guess I don't have anything.
Okay,
good.
I note for the record, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Gaddis, Representative Munoz have joined us also. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious what the status is now on the payment for the highest income bracket. I believe it was $47. When is that scheduled to? I guess it's scheduled to go to the end of the fiscal year. Could you just kind of give me an update on that, please?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Munoz. Yes, the $47 per month for the highest income bracket was effective March 1st, and it's scheduled to go through the current fiscal year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And of these individuals, do you know which bracket they were a part of, the 16, whether lowest or highest or middle?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I can't remember. It's been a number of months since I looked at these. I think I did an average. So there were some in each bracket. I don't remember the exact numbers.
Thank you. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, certainly I've gotten a lot of calls in regards to that, and some of I brought on myself. I'll openly admit that. That being said, playing in the background was this particular issue on the high end of the senior benefits program, and I still get calls. And so two questions. One is, how long did you know? I mean, so whether you agree with the philosophy or not on the higher end, I think my biggest challenges are little to no notice on people on a fixed income getting relatively no notice before
Chairman,
they.
Point of order, please.
Representative Gaddis.
This is not the bill. The bill is only about
that's
qualifications.
Not addressed in this bill. Just some eligibilities is all. Not
right. But I guess since we brought up that third layer.
Let's stick to
thank you. We'll stick to the subject. And if we could talk afterward, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Further questions on eligibility? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just a second ago when you were answering Representative Guttenberg's question about you don't actually check or you don't actually verify that they have citizenship. So are there no audits that are done, or is it just on a is it kind of like the permanent fund division where they have three investigators, they try to find anybody who's applied illegally? Is that the same thing that you would do here, or?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we do have an annual renewal policy for senior benefits, so when we get the renewal each year, we double-check the qualifications. Citizenship has never been a requirement for senior benefits, so it's not something that we have looked for.
And then, so follow
up.
So in the future, would you require that of a person? Would you require a certificate, a birth certificate, or some other certificate of naturalization?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we would check. We verify citizenship a number of ways. First, we use some interfaces to verify. We have access to INS information, so we can look them up. And we do for all of our other programs, so that would become routine for senior benefits as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any further questions from committee? Seeing none, I'm going to open the House Senate Bill 147 to public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify to Senate Bill 147? Seeing none, is there anybody online? There's no one online and no one in the room. I will close public testimony. Does the sponsor have any further comments?
Through the chair, we have no further comments. Again, we just appreciate the consideration and support. Thank you.
OK. Okay, I will walk us through the fiscal notes. Senate Bill 147 has one fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services, appropriation, public assistance, allocation, senior benefits, payment program, OMB component number 2897. Representative Munoz, can I have a motion to move CSSB 147S version W from committee?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. I think there's a question before we move.
Another question, Representative Kyle.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is to the department. There's 16 people here who have applied who didn't know that they weren't allowed to apply. And it was my understanding, too, when we passed this legislation a number of years ago that it was going to be for citizens. Do the 16 people know that they're going to get bumped?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we have not notified them yet because this bill has not been passed yet. When it does pass, we will notify them.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move committee substitute for Senate Bill 147, HSS version 296S2770W, senior benefits program eligibility from the House Finance Committee, and ask for unanimous consent.
Would you read that version again, please?
I'm sorry. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 147, HESS, or HSS, version 29GS2770W.
All right. Thank you. Is there any objections? Hearing no objections, CSSB 147 has passed our committee, moving forward. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the document. We're back on the record. Next, we will hear SCR 1, Civics Education Task Force, by Senator Stevens. Here to present the bill is Senator Stevens and his staff, Tim Lampkin. Mr. Lampkin, Senator Stevens, please come forward, place yourselves on the record, and tell us about SCR 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Stevens, Senator from Kodiak. I just ran over from the other building here, another hearing, so I appreciate you giving us a chance to talk to you about this bill. You know, I guess what always takes me back as a history professor to the issue of when in 1787 Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia, and when Benjamin Franklin came out of the meeting, an elderly woman said, what kind of a government have you given us, Mr. Franklin? And his response was, a republic if you can keep it. Now, that's a very key thing, I think, because I'm not sure that our young kids today can really keep our republic. I don't know that they know the basic elements of being a government, of being a democracy, of being a republic, and what it means to be a citizen and to be a voter, and more than that, to be a part of your community. So this resolution is intended to establish a task force who, over the interim, will be looking at how we can help our teachers and our school districts to see that our students are better educated in terms of being citizens. That's really all it is. There is a little clause that you may not know of in the ESSA, the new funding for education, replacing No Child Left Behind, which puts some funds aside to help nonprofits do exactly this, to find ways to help our students, our young people, understand what it means to be a citizen. So I'm anxious to see this task force get kicked off and begin work and try to find ways that we can actually do this. Tim Lamkin, on my staff, has been working on this for a very long time and is probably more conversant than I am about those issues, but between the two of us, we'll try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I see that the fiscal note has been zeroed out. So how does that affect page 3, line 31, where further resolve that members of the task force serve without compensation but be entitled to per diem and travel expenses authorized for boards and commissions?
Tim, if you'd answer that.
For the record, my name is Tim Lamkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if you'll note the analysis in the fiscal note itself, the members of the task force would be paying for their own way, respectively. So any member that's part of the task force, say, for example, if they represent the university, they would use the university funds to pay respective per diem. It's also intended that the members of the task force live in the Anchorage area, perhaps, or be. We would ask that the speaker and the Senate president would be conscientious of where the members are from to minimize costs.
Representative Wilson.
Follow up. Well, first of all, nothing against Anchorage, but some of us don't live there. But on our new fiscal note, we didn't get page 2, which on the original one there was a page 2 that basically stated, as he did, to where everybody else would be paid. So I'm assuming the per diem and travel expenses would be by anybody who was being sent by a different entity besides the legislature.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. I was just showing that I was reading the fiscal notes.
Correct. Further questions from committee? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Stevens. We go through a lot of machinations in this building about not enough civics, not enough constitutionalism. I'm still not sure what that is. And I'm never quite sure where the input is coming from, but about kids not being engaged enough. I mean, I certainly remember from early grade school having classes and part of the curriculum about the Constitution and doing all kinds of, you know, supposedly engaging things for students. Do you come from a point where there's a question about what we're doing? I mean, and have been able to accumulate that information from school boards of what's being taught?
Well, thank you. Through the chair, I have to base it somewhat on my personal experience. And I, too, when I was in school, we had current events. We learned what it meant to be a citizen. We learned about the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and all of that. And having visited many schools and spent time in the classroom as a guest of high school teachers, history teachers, I was just shocked at how first, students had no idea that I was a state senator. They thought I was from Washington, D.C. They had no idea there was a difference. They simply did not understand that. And so I think it's all, from my standpoint, I don't know that there's any study we can go back to at this point and say, you know, we can prove that they don't know as much as maybe we did when we were kids. But my experience would tell me that that is the case, that there simply is not that basic information out there. That and in fact, I think we should all take that immigrant test that shows whether you know the basics of being a citizen yourself. I'm sure you would pass it.
Yeah, just a follow-up. Thank you,
Representative Guttenberg.
I have adults tell me asks me when I move back from Washington, D.C. Just amazes me. And I remember as a child, Alaska becoming a state, and the class assignment was to draw the new flag with new stairs. But it is troubling me because I don't know. But I've done We the People classes in schools, and all that stuff's wonderful. But I think we do need to get a better understanding. Maybe it's adequate. Maybe we're missing it. I don't know what it is, but thank you.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up a little bit. I think one of the things I'd like to see an outcome of this task force is where they want to go and what they want to do. But in Massachusetts, they put some money together, the state, and they brought teachers into Boston and tried to help them. How could they, in their classroom, help students understand what it means to be a citizen? If you were teaching a American Lit class, what could you do? You read Barbara Fitchie, or you could talk about the Civil War. Or, you know, in history classes, it's much more obvious. But the program in Boston put together these monies that helped teachers become better at helping students understand.
Follow up, Representative Guttenberg.
No, I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from committee, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I appreciate you doing this. I think we are in this whole world of STEM is the best thing in the world for education. People are forgetting that as people go into the world and they want to try and change things, they can learn a lot from how people changed things in the past or didn't. And so I think this is great. The one thing I don't like is that you will teach people that to realize that you're not a congressional representative when you're not, because one of my favorite moments a few weeks ago, now a little longer ago, was when Representative Young went up to somebody that I knew, a young woman, and said, "Did you know I was your congressman?" And she said, "You're not my congressman. Les is my congressman." So. I guess I'll lose out on that.
Overall scared.
Thank you, Representative Garrett.
Story.
Any further questions from committee?
I just have one quick question.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Senator. Do you intend this to use the current framework and curricular requirements that we currently have in place, or are you looking to expand the curricular requirements for history and American government?
Thank you, through the chair. That's a very good question, and the answer is that no, we're not trying to change the curriculum. You know, I'd like to see us have a designated class that teaches civics, but that's not going to happen without money attached to it. And so I think this is a way to approach a little differently without a lot of money, which we're all looking at. How can we afford to have education without spending additional dollars? So the goal here is, and I really appreciate Representative Garrett's comment too about STEM. You know, I mean, we truly have focused on sort of the higher skills and have sort of lost some of the more life-affirming issues, I think, in our school. So absolutely, we would not be changing the curriculum at all. Just having teachers becoming a little more conversant with what's going on in their class.
And to clarify, I wasn't so concerned with changing curriculum as adding additional graduation requirements in the area of history or American government, and you know, trying to clarify if that was the intention or not.
Thank you, through the chair. That's not our intention. I know there are some there has been some talk, particularly on your side of the building, to require students to take a basic exam new citizens have to take. That's not a part of this, is it, Tim? Maybe you can help us, because we have talked about it at various times. But I don't think we added that, Tim.
Lampkin.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, actually in House Education Committee, there is a section in the new version of the bill that would, on page 2, lines 14 through 20, which would ask that the task force evaluate the merits of implementation requirements for requiring that very test that you refer to. And on that point, if I might share with you, I have an interesting statistic. This test that we're talking about here is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services exam that every person wishing to become a citizen and enter this country has to take this and pass this exam. On that exam are 100 questions, and they range from things like what is the First Amendment, how many members of Congress do we have, what are the Bill of Rights, and so forth. In order to pass that test, these incoming citizens have to only get 60% of those questions correct. In a poll or the survey that was done in 2014, 92% of these immigrants are passing this test. That same exact test was given to students in Arizona and Oklahoma. 3% of the graduating seniors in Arizona were passing that test. 4% of them in Oklahoma were passing that test. So that is perhaps an indication of what kind of problem we're looking at and would like to address.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks.
All right,
thank Mr. Chairman, we'd be glad to provide you with that test if your kid members are care to take it.
I don't know if anybody here at this committee would pass
in
it.
Your packet.
Okay. We take well, the fifth I've got some minute. Questions for you, Gary.
All right. Also online, we do have Michael Polyakov, a Ph.D., Vice President of Policy, American Council of Trustees and Alumni, for questions also, if anybody has any. And I'll go around. There's no other questions from committee. Thank you, Senator and Mr. Lampkin. At this time, I'd like to open SCR 1 for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify to SCR 1? Seeing none, is there anybody else online? Seeing none there, public testimony is closed. All right. Does the sponsor have any further comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this. I certainly appreciate you doing it.
I did have some questions about the fiscal note. It kind of bothered me a little bit, but it is a page one of one page, and there is a notation on it that does state that the House Education Committee zeroed out this one-page fiscal note and anticipate the travel costs can be absorbed. Yet it still exists in the bill. It says that their travel costs, they're entitled to travel costs. So this is a little bit bothersome, but we are going to move it probably forward with a zero fiscal note. Representative Wilson, you had a question?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, and I did realize that this was a new fiscal note. The previous one just had two pages to it and had just more explanation about that they were going to use telephonic measures, actually use our way of communicating without necessarily everybody coming there. And I'm okay with the explanation that somebody else from maybe the university or someone else might attend, and then it would be up to them whether or not they already have legal obligations to do a per diem. But hopefully we'll let the university know that they can call in by phone, too.
All right, thank you. On the physical note, we have 10 physical note from Alaska Legislature, Appropriation Council, Allocation, Council and Subcommittee, OMB Component Number 783. And Representative Munoz, can I have a motion to pass SCR 1 from committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move a House committee substitute for committee substitute for SCR 1 EDC Education Version 29 LS0237/G from committee.
With attached zero physical note and individual committee recommendations.
Yes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, SCR 1 is moved from committee. And we'll take a brief at ease. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
We're back on the record. Next, we'll hear House Bill 317, Forfeiture, No Civil in Rem, Only Criminal, by Representative Wilson. Here to speak to the Committee on House Bill 317 is sponsor, Representative Tammy Wilson. Please place yourself on the record and tell us about the bill and the difference between versions E and A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 3, North Pole. CHHB 317 does not allow law enforcement to seize your property without first charging you. That's what it does, Mr. Chairman. Now, to go on to explanation of changes, Section 9.55 was amended to add a new subsection to abolish MREM forfeiture actions and provide for an effective date. All other sections have been deleted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Questions from committee? For some reason, I don't have a copy of the bill.
It is pretty large, I can see.
Do you have a, does everybody have a copy of the bill?
It's just one page.
Brief of these.
Yeah, it's one page.
Questions from committee? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. There's some backup letters here, and some of the comments maybe were addressing the previous version of the bill, but just a question on, like, when a person gets pulled over for DUI, I guess I don't know the process since I've never been pulled over for DUI, but are they charged immediately at the time of arrest?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, first of all, the letters that you have in there are for the larger bill, and we're going to be in the interim working with all the different agencies that you see letters there for that. When you're pulled over, you are, yes, you are charged. What this would do is that I couldn't arrest this chair and take it to court and try to let it speak for itself of why I shouldn't have arrested it. You actually have to have a charge on a person, not the property, and that's all this does is make it to where you can't take the property and basically take it to court and expect it to testify, because it can't. It really is that simple.
Now I'm really confused.
Mr. Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So civil asset forfeiture is typically used in criminal cases, like for drug offenses. That's like a common one where a drug dealer, so they confiscate the phone, they confiscate assets that are there. How would that impact that particular process that happens right now?
Well, Mr. Kawasaki, through the chair, there are many forfeiture laws, and those laws all will stay in place. We do have people online that could give you a better explanation, but this is a process that we were told in judiciary that is not currently being used at all, and that's why we're just deleting it. There are, again, the bill was very big. What we tried to do is bring all the forfeiture portions and through all the different statutes and put them all in one bill. And it added a very large fiscal note, and I think we'll be able to bring that fiscal note down, but it's going to take time to work with the departments versus what we have time to do right now. So this is part of the statute that is not being utilized, and we do have a testifier that is dealing with this and can give you a better explanation than I.
Okay, that's fine.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Chair. I like the way the sponsor described the bill. Except for the talking furniture part.
Sorry.
Is there an attorney online who can just – I just have
– We have some people here that I wanted to ask some questions of in the room. We have Kent Sullivan, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law, and we have John Skidmore, Criminal Division Director, Department of Law, in the room. And there is a memo that was sent out just about noon today that I'm going to ask them some questions about.
Okay.
They had some concerns. Is that sufficient for?
Yeah, that would be fine to ask questions too.
And okay. Mr. Chairman, we also have Megan Wallace, who helped with the legislation, should be online as well from Ledge Legal.
Okay. Okay, I'll ask. I'll throw out a question when they're all here and see who wants to answer it.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, the sponsor. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Representative Wilson, excuse me.
Okay.
At this time, I would like to call up Kent Sullivan, Attorney, Assistant Attorney General, and John Skidmore with the Department of Law. If you would both please put yourselves on the record.
Good afternoon. Kent Sullivan with Department of Law and Natural Resources Section.
And I'm John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law.
Yes, we received an email. In fact, I got it at 1:04 p.m. today, and I noticed that the sponsor didn't get it until nearly noon when we were on the floor. And it states that the Department of Law has some concerns and suggested language, and I just want you to address that, please, so we make sure we get it on the record.
So I'll start. This is John Skidmore for the record. The 317 was introduced in House Judiciary, and at the time, as has already been alluded to, the bill was quite larger and was trying to do a number of other things. There were some concerns with trying to do all of those things in the way in which they were originally proposed in the bill, and as a result, it was pared down to just the language that you see in front of you. And as a result of that, I had been testifying, and the Criminal Division didn't see any problems with that. We don't file charges against property, the chair, as Rep. Wilson talked about. We don't use that process in criminal cases. We simply file charges against an individual, and if there is property associated with that case and the charges against the individual, we would seek forfeiture through the criminal process. So we didn't see any problems with that within the Criminal Division. We were adjusting our fiscal note, and at the time we adjusted the fiscal note given the revisions in the bill. That went through the entire department, and it was at that time, I believe, the Civil Division began to look at it and identified some concerns because they weren't quite sure what the bill was aimed at. And with that sort of introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Sullivan so that he can describe the concerns the Civil Division saw.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess the concerns from the Civil Division side are that certainly the intent of the bill is understood, and how the bill is supposed to be applied or intended to be applied. The concern is that there may be unintended consequences on the civil side of things. I've been practicing civil litigation for approximately 20 years. I do a tremendous amount of real property litigation, quiet title actions, involved in condemnation actions, that sort of thing. I've also done quite a bit of work in probate. And there's many areas on the civil side of things that do involve in rem actions against property that might be construed in some way, shape, or form to constitute a civil forfeiture. And the concern here is that does this bill potentially touch upon those? Could it impact those types of actions? And I don't mean to suggest that this bill necessarily does that. It's unclear to me whether it might at this point. I think there would potentially need to be some clarification by the courts as to whether exactly the way it's worded right here, whether it would impact so many of these types of things that I've referenced. And I can give you a few examples of those. For instance, down here in southeast Alaska, it's not uncommon for Department of Natural Resources to find float houses setting upon state tidelands, very large float houses, very valuable float houses, and DNR can go out and generally there's a lease that's needed or a permit that's needed in order for those float houses to be in place. And DNR will go and check its records and determine that in such and such a bay, in this location, there's no authorization or permit for a float house to be placed there. How does DNR go about moving that, getting rid of it? There's nobody around. There's no AK vessel numbers on the float house. There's no documentation within the float house to say who it may belong to, or if there is documentation, perhaps that person is no longer in the state or no longer in the country. how does DNR effectively get rid of that float house or that piece of property? Well, one way of doing that is to institute a cause of action against the property itself that basically gives the court authority over that property, allows for potential owners to be notified, whether it be by publication or whatever, and allows the action to proceed against that property and anybody who might make a claim to it to go ahead and raise their entitlement to it and their justification for it being where it needs to be. And then if they don't do that, then that's something that the courts, through forfeiture and in rem proceedings, have allowed the state or whoever's filing the proceeding to go ahead and then take action. And the concern, and that's just one example. There's many, many examples. There's examples of private property owners that find abandoned property on their own private property, and they want to develop their property or get rid of mining equipment or whatever the case may be, derelict vessels, motor vehicles, you name it. There's also probate proceedings, where in probate proceedings, if somebody dies intestate without a will, they haven't left any heirs, ultimately property may escheat to the state. It may wind up in the hands of the state through processes that allow that to occur through court proceedings as against the property. And certainly it's understood that within the law, many of these types of issues with derelict vessels and with vehicles and abandoned property and salvaging a property, vessels that are lost and are salvaged, there's statutes that to some extent may touch upon small areas of those proceedings, just like with quiet title actions or with condemnation proceedings that I practice in all the time. State statutes allow a quiet title action. However, state statutes don't spell out all the parameters and all the details of quiet title actions. Many, many, many of those details, those holes, are filled in by common law. To what extent does the wording of this bill potentially impact those? And again, I'm not certain that it does. All I'm suggesting is we haven't had time to thoroughly make sure that that what's been articulated here with this bill will have no impact civilly with regard to these types of issues. And so we've suggested some alternative language in this.
Representative Guerra has some questions.
Yes.
I'm sorry, could I have your name again?
It's Kent Sullivan with Department of Law.
Hi, Mr. Sullivan. So I have a transition from your job at the Department of Law into Representative Wilson's job over here at the legislature. And I will tell you that when I see a bill that I support or that I have no opinion on either way, it doesn't do any more harm than good, I support it and I want it to move forward. I want this to move forward. Representative Wilson seems to have compromised a lot on the bill. And so let's come up with the language that works. Representative Wilson's concern was that without there's been no criminal charge, and obviously you don't want to be able to take away somebody's property without a criminal charge, correct? And of course, we want to make sure that doesn't happen. So the bill talks about common law in rem forfeiture. And what you're saying is you don't want a situation where civilly somebody's got a piece of property, for example, in a place where they're not allowed to have a piece of property. How do you get them to remove it? And I understand that. Well, you get them to remove it by getting to a final judgment or a settlement. So so before I ask my question, what is an in rem forfeiture? Can you say that in two sentences?
And in Representative Guerra, through the chair, an in rem forfeiture is a proceeding as against the property as opposed to the person. And back to your question of you or your statement that you get a judgment against the person, there are many, many instances where it's impossible to get a judgment against the person. many instances. Okay. For instance, you don't know who owns the property. You cannot reasonably find out who owns the property is one, because it has nothing to tie it to an owner.
Okay, can you offer
yes.
Representative Guerra.
So I didn't mean a judgment against the person. So what if it to address the situation you're talking about, and let's say it's a piece of property that's built on a tied land where it's not allowed to be built. And obviously you've done everything to figure out who owns it, and in good faith you can't find that person, and under the legal standards then you're allowed to go against the property. But, of course, we wouldn't want you to be able to take it down unless you got a judgment, right? So what would be wrong with just having this bill saying these in commons law civil interim forfeiture actions are abolished, comma, unless there has been a final court judgment? Right, because then you've got a court judgment, or obviously you might have a settlement in the middle. But then, isn't everybody's interest satisfied? You now have proven your case, you against the human being or the property, and then it's okay. So what's wrong with that? Because I can't understand the language that you have in here. You're talking about civil cases, criminal cases, all in one.
Did you look at page 2 on the?
I did, email. Mr. Chair, and the proposed amendment reads vaguely. So I'm just wondering.
Right.
What's wrong with the language that would say a common law civil interim forfeiture, common law interim forfeiture actions are abolished, comma, unless there has been a final court judgment?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, and I don't want to speak too quickly, but my initial reaction to that is that might work. The question that I would have is, in all instances where there's actually, is there actually a judgment? There may be in some of these examples given, like with probate proceedings, disclaimers of property, disavowing of property, and that type of thing, where there's not actually a judgment that's given. Number two, getting the judgment is, and needing to have a judgment is sort of putting the last piece in the process first. And just to make sure that we're looking, yes.
Representative Guerra.
Through the chair, what about without a court order? Right, so that way you don't have to wait for the judgment. You get a preliminary injunction, there's a court order, it says that property should be removed. At least you've gone through a process. That's not the government doing it without the safety check of the approving your case.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, again, I think both of those may well achieve that, and I'm not necessarily saying that they wouldn't. Just to make sure that we're talking about the same language that was suggested late today, I believe there was some language proposed that civil interim forfeiture actions are abolished if used instead of a criminal proceeding. Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, that just seems really vague to me. I mean, what if... through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
What your language would say is that we have to show that somebody used this instead of using a criminal proceeding, and then, I mean, doesn't that get into a back and forth as to why they did the civil forfeiture, whether they did it instead of a criminal forfeiture? Do you have to prove that was their intent? I only practiced law for 13 years, okay? But that does not jump out at me as clear language, whereas the language I proposed, unless there's been a valid court order, does seem to be clearer.
And you're suggesting are abolished unless there's been a valid court order?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the word abolish is a little weird in that circumstance, but we basically want you to wait for you to have a court order. We don't want you going in and taking the property before you have a court order.
Understood. And Representative Guerra, through the chair, and you're asking me to think very quickly here on my feet, and I want to apologize if I speak too quickly. But one of the concerns that I might see is that that would allow a court order in a criminal proceeding, which would seem to defeat what the intent may be here. I mean, if the intent is to only abolish the use of civil forfeiture unless there's a court order, then that may well be workable. If what the intent is to abolish the use of civil in rem forfeiture, even when used in a criminal proceeding context, then that may not achieve that intent. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Representative Garrett.
I defer to Representative Wilson. If I understand Representative Wilson's concern, she, and I could misunderstand it, she doesn't mind as long as there's actually been a charge and an order. What she doesn't want is for a law enforcement to be able to go in and do something without having a court order, I think.
You're right.
And Representative Guerra, through the chair, it may well be that using language referencing an order or referencing a judgment may address the concern from the civil side of things.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Let me give you this language to mull over, and you can see whether it works. And it would say, common law civil in rem forfeiture actions are, and then there I would say, prohibited unless there has been a court order. I guess they're not abolished. You'd have to wait until you got a court order.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We do have a little bit of time because we're going to go through public testimony, and then we'll have you come back up probably if you want to look that over, give some consideration.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Any further questions?
I have one question.
Representative Munoz. So,
thank you. In the example that you gave where you're trying to remove a houseboat and you cannot locate the owner, do you go through a court order with that process, or how would you finalize that?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, yes, there would be a court process that would be followed, similar to a quiet title action. In all likelihood, it would entail publication and providing notice to the public that this is the piece of property that's at issue. Anybody that's claiming an interest in that piece of property, please, you know, come let the court know what your interest is and any objections that you may have to what's happening, that type of thing. Very, very similar to a quiet title action.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right, thank you. We also have online Peter Sandberg, private attorney with Ingelson Fitzgerald. We have Megan Wallace from Ledge Legal, who's a drafter. Merge Bernard Chastain, Alaska Wildlife Trooper, and Jeff Laughlin, Alaska State Troopers. They're all online for questions if you have any of them. And Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I would just ask the state trooper online right now.
Mr. Laughlin, please, are you there?
Thank you. Is there any circumstance where you would take somebody's property without a court order? So you see something, you think it's illegal, and you would make the property forfeited before getting a court order?
Hi, thank you. My name is Jeff Laughlin. I am a captain with the Alaska State Troopers based here out of Anchorage. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I testified previously on this bill, and in recent memory, and certainly with my involvement as a statewide drug enforcement commander, we at the state level have not taken somebody's property in any case in which criminal charges have not been filed. I think that was your question.
Representative Guerra.
So, yeah, I understand you come to the scene of a murder, you arrest somebody, he's got an Uzi, and you might confiscate the Uzi in a criminal case, but we're talking about civil cases, right? So I guess I'm not sure what my question is at this point. I guess I could see that. I know in criminal cases people will confiscate a weapon. But.
I think we've all seen samples of seizures that don't sound right. We've seen them on TV where a gentleman will be stopped as he's driving through a state, and they have him look in his trunk, and he's got $12,000 in cash, and they seize that. And he says, I'm going to buy a car. And they said, no, you're going to go buy drugs. We're keeping the money. That's the type of thing that Representative Wilson is trying to eliminate from possibly happening here. Sounds like it probably hasn't happened that we know of in the state, but this is what the purpose of this legislation is. Any further questions from committee at this time? Okay, seeing none, at this time we're going to open House Bill 317 for public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify to House Bill 317? Seeing none, is there anybody else online wishing to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Okay. Representative Wilson, did you want to make an amendment? Or do you want to wait for their reply? Do you want to take a brief at ease and discuss with them?
No, I'm fine moving along. Don't need an at ease.
Well, I would like to have some clarification to make sure we aren't doing something that's...
And, Mr. Chairman, I think we should probably have... I don't know whether you would prefer to have the amendments or they're speaking to exactly, which one we're... Can we have a brief at ease?
Well, we're going to do a brief at ease. Please. Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer conceptual amendment number one that would delete the word abolished and insert prohibited unless there is a court order.
Is there any objection to the amendment? Conceptual amendment is accepted. All right. I will now move on to fiscal notes. Yes, Representative Kawasaki.
I think that the word abolished in the title also needs to be changed. Is that right?
It's not in the title of my bill.
It's in section nine. Just look at line five.
Line five.
Well, I think the title's going through a change anyway.
I think you just take out the word abolished.
Yeah. Or prohibited.
Okay, yeah.
That's amendment number two.
All right. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have accepted the amendment, the conceptual amendment to House Bill 317. And the other problem will be a conforming change by when they finalize the bill. It's not a title change. Pardon?
On line five, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that is no problem. So, fiscal notes. First, we have fiscal note number one from the Department of Administration, Appropriation, Legal and Advocacy Services, Allocation Office of Public Advocacy, OMB, component number 43. That's a zero fiscal note. Fiscal note number two is zero fiscal note from the Department of Administration, Appropriations, is Legal and Advocacy Services, Allocation Public Defender Agency, OMB, component number 1631. Zero fiscal note number three is from the Department of Law, Appropriation, Administration, and Support, Allocation Office of the Attorney General, OMB, component number 2162. And we have an indeterminate fiscal note number four from the Department of Public Safety, Appropriation, Statewide Support, Allocation, Commissioner's Office, OMB, component number 523. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill 317, Judiciary, version 29, LS1380E, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
Is there any objection, Representative Pruitt?
Just a quick question. Recognizing that there was there's another conforming something that conforming that should be made. Should we also request in the motion that, as we do in some other cases, that legal make any conforming changes as necessary?
Yeah, I don't think we need. I will state that now. In fact, you just have.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Legal can make any conforming changes to comply with what we've just completed. All right. With that, any objections? Seeing none, we have moved House Bill 317 as amended from committee, and with that, I would like to remind members, Representative Guerra, that I have been chastised because I let members address each other by their name. We're supposed to, when we are in committee, do the same as we do on the floor. Seems kind of cumbersome when we have such a tight little group and we're friends, but we have to comply. So with that, the next House Finance Committee meeting is today, April 12th, 2016 at 5 p.m., and at that meeting we will hear HB 245, Permanent Fund Deposits, Dividends, and Earnings, and we'll have a presentation at that time. With that, at 2:42 p.m., we are adjourned.